Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am O'Brien McMahon, and this is People Business. In this episode, I'm joined by Pinky Reyna, CFO at Ideal Industries, a $400 million manufacturing company with a global footprint. She leads several enterprise-wide transformation initiatives, enabling the company's business model to adapt to changing market conditions and disruptive market forces. She's focused on the financial strategy to position the organization for continued growth. Prior to joining Ideal, Pinky was the CFO and COO at US Soccer, where she led the organization through its challenges in a highly visible media environment, including the women's national team equity pay litigation. She was central to the company's most significant commercial, legal, operational, and financial events, including the decision to manage commercial rights in-house, signing new collective bargaining agreements, and managing liquidity during COVID-19. In this conversation, we kind of start at the beginning of what it means to be a CFO, and she really unpacks how she thinks about her role, the mindset she has while doing her role, how she analyzes her team, makes assessments, builds succession planning. And we even talk about how she thinks about human capital as a CFO. She's got a really interesting take that I won't give away here, but she's got a really interesting perspective and has had some interesting experiences that have led to that perspective. This was an eye-opening conversation for me. I think it will be for a lot of folks who listen to this podcast. I really hope you enjoy it. Here is Pinky Reyna. Pinky, welcome to the show. Excited to have you on. I've had another CFO friend of mine on before, but it was a very different conversation than I think the one that we're going to have. And so I'm really interested in diving into the role of the CFO and what that is and your take on it, having had some unique experience. I'll just say that now. We'll kind of tease that for what that means as we get into the show. But welcome.
Looking forward to the conversation.
This is going to be a dumb first question, but I think it's worth asking. We'll see. What is a CFO's job? We think obviously, you know, oh, well, you run finance, you the money, you handle all the money, but the job is more than that. What do you think about when you think of the roles and responsibilities of a chief financial officer?
Yeah, so I mean, I think what you normally hear people say is maximizing shareholder value, right? And I think that's got a very public company edge to it. But overall, as I kind of think about it, is you're accelerating the value creation, and whether you're accelerating the value creation for your shareholders, public or private. The other aspect of it is you want to make sure that the shareholder value creation is both quantitative and qualitative. So folks always focus on the numbers, but there's a qualitative aspect to it too, which is the people in the organization. So when you're making these changes, people should feel the changes, they should embrace the changes, they should be a part of the change.
Tell me more about that, because as soon as you said shareholder value, I was like, all right, here we go. We're going to go off script right away and unpack this a little bit, because shareholder value is such a common phrase, but I think a lot of people are rethinking that as far as the primary driver, the sole driver of any business is maximizing shareholder value. It can come with a lot of baggage and bias around, you know, kind of the opposite of what you just said, just looking only at the quantitative, driving hard for the numbers, cutting anything that can be cut, and often whoever can be cut to drive this shareholder value, this endless profit. You just talked about balancing both. So how do you think about accelerating value creation, and like, what does it really mean to you?
Yeah, so the acceleration of value creation from a quantitative standpoint sometimes can be a very short-term approach. You know, especially on the public company side, you'll have your quarterly earnings. So you're going from quarter to quarter and you're being measured on where your share price is, right? On the private companies, I feel like you've got more of a shield because you're not beheld to a quarterly call or a share price. But I think at the end of the day, it's growth, right? And it's long-term growth. So how are you driving long-term growth? And that long-term growth, if it's coming from constant restructurings or cost cutting, I don't think that is a recipe for long-term growth, because those measures will help you in the short term, But overall, you're going to need those resources or that capital to be deployed for that long-term growth. So that's why I kind of made that distinction. The other thing is people. A lot of the restructurings don't end up being just process restructurings, they end up being people restructurings. So, you know, you end up losing people in the business. And if you want to, again, drive long-term growth, if you don't have those people or those resources to help make those investments now, then you're going to be having more of a short-term thinking around all of this and suffer potentially in the long-term.
So let's pause that for a second, because I want to unpack just the role of a CFO. And that's a steep cliff. When if we lean too far over it, I think we'll just be off to the races. So you have the distinction of winning the award for CFO of the Year, which is one of the reasons I was excited to talk to you. What makes a good CFO?
Well, I would say in any leadership role that's got a C next to it, chief, you have to make sure that your team's kind of bought into whatever your vision is. Along with that, I think on the CFO side, you need to make sure that you're fearless and you have a can-do attitude, because a lot of times when the organization is struggling, whether it's with the financial issue, whether it is with COVID, they come to the CFO and they said, okay, what should we do over here? And it's a delicate balance of trying to figure out how to navigate the organization during these, you know, troubling times that nobody has ever experienced before. So you have to have, I would say, even presence of mind, a can-do attitude, and just be fearless, because you're going to come up with solutions that potentially have never been done before. And if you are scared or if you're unsure, then everybody in the organization is going to feel that fear, and so are your peers. And then you're potentially going to be in a place where you really, you know, struggle to figure out how to move the organization forward. So in trying times, CFOs are really leaned upon to, you know, fearlessly navigate the organization.
So I'm already taking notes and adding questions that were not on script here. This is great right off the bat. I love talking about mindset. And CFOs do not have a reputation for being visionaries necessarily. And I think the bias more would be toward cost cutting and really watching the purse strings. And, you know, it can be more of a scarcity perception, I'll say. You know, the perception is mm-hmm. that there's some scarcity in the finance department. But what I'm hearing from you is not scarcity at all. It's almost aggressiveness to go out and make moves. Some of that could be cutting, but some of that is going to be investing, and it's all around getting the organization focused on growth. So can you just talk to maybe that bias? What do you see among your peers? Does everybody have the mindset that you're talking about, or are you kind of the rare bird?
You know what? I think it's depending on circumstances and the industry that you're in. So I've been fortunate enough that I've been in a public company, in a private company, in a not-for-profit. And in each of those arenas, I really tried to figure out, like, what is the level of flexibility that I have? And I will say, in the public and company environment, you have the least flexibility. So as a result, in those environments, I mean, you really have to be mindful of, you know, whether you're really being able to make the calls that you want to make to invest in the long-term growth, because sometimes some of those moves have to be short-term. The private and the not-for-profit arenas, I feel, gives you more flexibility. And in that, you can decide when you need to be that tactical CFO and when you can actually be the strategic CFO. So being able to do both is important, because when you're called upon to be the strategic CFO, you need to be able to answer that call and say, hey, you know, I have a growth mindset. I want to be able to do these things. I think we should do all these things, but are we at a point where we are ready for it?
Yeah. Let's talk about public versus private for a second, because, you know, like mm-hmm. you said, you've worked in kind of public, private, nonprofit, and I've never worked for a public company. I've definitely never run finance for a public company, but you hear all the time, you know, oh, it's all about the next quarterly earnings call, and you hear about the restrictions that you're talking about. What is that? How real is it? How handicapped are you? You mentioned having to think short-term sometimes. Where is that pressure coming from? Is it just that the board and the shareholders will fire an executive if they don't make their quarterly earnings? Like, there's that threat to perform, or is the pressure coming from somewhere else?
The pressure is coming from perception of the analysts. It's got nothing to really do with the company itself. Because what happens is when the CEO and the CFO have those quarterly calls with the analysts, and they're responding to, hey, you know, here's what we're expecting with organic growth. We're looking at acquisitions, or we're looking at divestitures. Here's kind of what the inflationary impact has been. Here's what's happening with supply chain. All of those things are getting factored into some kind of model. And that model is spitting out and saying, okay, and here's what the share price should be. And those discussions are so key, and those models, and you know, whether you should buy the stock, whether you should sell the stock, whether you should hold the stock, all of those things go so much into what is being done with the company or the information that's being shared, that it just puts that added pressure of what there could potentially be a disconnect between what is really happening in the company and what is being perceived as what's been happening in the company. And as a result, it is impacting the value creation, because the value creation is being driven by that share price.
Why would an executive care about that? And I get why in the long run you would care about that. But why do public executives care about that in the short run? Like, what are the repercussions of having your stock price dip for a few quarters when you know as an executive team that you're making these long-term adjustments?
I think it's kind of the way that we've all been programmed now. There are some folks out there, I would say they're scarce. I talk to my CEO all the time, and you know, we refer to, you know, what ITW did. And you need to have some of those CEOs who basically think that the analyst might have a point of view, but I know what's happening in my company and I feel comfortable in them putting in whatever they want in their models, but here's going to be our strategy and we're going to continue going forth in that path. So it just takes that conviction. So you have got those CEOs currently who have the conviction, and they're basically going to go do what they want to do. I'm not sure whether I want to quote Elon Musk there, but you know, I'll leave it at ITW. So.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, and these are genuine questions for me, because you know, it's easy for me on the outside to say, well, if I was one of those leaders, why wouldn't I just say, screw the analysts, like, let's go do what we need to do to build this business for the next decade. And it sounds like the only reason people don't do that is just because of the sort of societal pressure, almost peer pressure. Is that
fair?
Yeah,
it is. But even if you think about tenure, right? What is nowadays the tenure of CEOs and CFOs? 4 or 5 years?
Yeah.
So what is the incentive in them thinking 10 years?
Yeah.
So if they think 10 years, take the beating from the analysts during their 4 or 5 years, and then they're gone, and somebody else basically then gets to benefit based on the ideas that they put together. I don't know. That's a whole different topic of psychology and human behavior and motivation.
Yeah. Well, these are all things that I'm fascinated about, which is why I do a podcast on the human side of work. The other thing I'd like to see, and I've never seen the data on this before, but where executive turnover comes from. Because you hear that statistic, you know, it's 3 to 5 years. CEOs are in a public role for 3 to 5 years. CFOs, kind of same thing. But I'd be curious on what is causing that turnover. Is it that they're getting fired after that period of time? Or is it that they've earned a bunch of money and they're cashing out and moving on to the next thing? You know, because I think that would influence how I would feel about it as well. If it's not working out and they're getting let go after that period of time, maybe there is an argument to be made that we need to change the culture and start thinking more long-term, as that could have some repercussions. Again, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see.
I think it runs a wide gamut. Have those where, you know, they get into the CFO role and they really get to a point where maybe what's being asked of them is to be more tactical, and they see themselves as being more of a strategic player, and as a result are not really aligned with what the direction of the company is or what the vision of the CEO is. So again, I'm going to just continue to speak CFO, not CEO. In other cases, they're performing well. Others notice. And so they're given a bigger opportunity, and they take that on because they're like, hey, you know what? I've managed a $1 billion public company. Now I'm being given an opportunity to manage $5 billion. Now I'll be $10 billion. So it's that growth opportunity for them. And sometimes it's boredom. If you've got somebody who's like a real high achiever, a real go-getter, after a few years, they're just going to get bored and they're going to want to do something different. So they're not driven by a larger size of the company. It's just, let's do something different. I've got X number of years to be CFO. I want to be able to try 3 to 5 different industries and have a span at each of them for 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, that makes sense. Very, very fair. So we'll climb back out of that rabbit hole a little bit, but I want to stay on mindset for a second. Mm-hmm. How do you think about your own mindset? You know, do you journal? Do you reflect at any point? Do you read philosophy? Just curious how you sort of develop the mindset that you've developed over time, where it comes from.
I think it, for me, has been on the job. It's the different leaders that I've been exposed to. And I think I'd shared with you when we had done an initial debrief that when I joined Ideal, I told the CEO, I said, I've coined this new term, LOL. It's listen, observe, and learn. So I think in today's society, just because we're surrounded by so much social media, there are so many people who want to tell us so many things. I think we've forgotten how to listen. So everybody wants to say something, but nobody's really there listening to it. So I think for me, I've kept that as my mantra going into each of these roles, that the first couple of months, I'd really need to take time to listen to the organization, to listen to the people, understand what they see as the problems, because it's not going to be a cut, copy, paste approach for each organization. It's really going to be tailored to what those organizations' needs are. And that's why that listening period is so important.
How do you coach the people on your team to adopt a similar mindset? How do you coach them to slow down, listen, think, and then, make critical decisions?
I think you have to model that behavior. And that's why, going sort of off topic with this hybrid versus in-person, hybrid has given the flexibility to the workforce, which is great, but fully remote, I would stay away from, because for the younger workforce that's coming in, a lot of us have learned through seeing how leaders tackled problems, how they responded to problems in person. And that's how our approach got molded. So if they really want to figure that out for themselves in terms of what kind of leader they're going to be, some of that FaceTime and being in person is going to be important.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know why this popped into my head, but Hamilton, The Room Where It Happened. If that song, for anyone who's listened to it, it's when they're making special decisions. And it's like, that's almost kind of where we are now. Like nobody knows what went on in the room where it happened. And it's kind of like what's going on in Zoom meetings right now, right? Like nobody else has any idea what's going on. But there are so many opportunities when you are actually in a workplace with a lot of other people, just when you're with a lot of other people, that like stuff permeates. You kind of get to see how people behave. You get to see how some decisions are made. Maybe not all of them, but you just get a lot more exposure than you would if everything's happening remotely.
Yeah. So the former CEO of US Soccer, Dan Flynn, the one who hired me at US Soccer, used to say, when I'm coming in the day, I really don't know what are the things that are going to cross my desk. But knowing that my chief legal officer and my chief finance officer and my chief HR officer and my chief commercial officer are right there, whatever problem comes, I can just walk over. It's probably not going to be on my agenda, and have that conversation, understand like what their perspective is, and then go back and address it. If I'm in a remote setup, then I'm like, okay, I actually need my chief financial officer and my chief legal officer. So, hey, executive assistant, can you help set up a call for us to get on for 30 minutes? So that fluidity of really not knowing what problems are going to cross your desk and who you might need to partner with gets impacted. It becomes a bit more unnatural to try and solve those problems. And the second CEO who came in at US Soccer, Will Wilson, he actually experienced that, because he started as a CEO when we were in COVID. So he was not able to have real-time interactions with his team. He was having to solve problems on Zoom calls.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm fully in the camp that I think having flexibility and allowing people to be responsible for their own lives in whatever way they need to is great and empowering. And I love that we've given people that autonomy in the hybrid setting. But by the same token, I think there's so much value to being around other people. And one is how work gets done, but two, there's so much personal value to being around people. I story I tell is I was sitting in my office and I walked over to ask a business question of the person in the office next to me, and he helped me with my problem. And then he asked me just a question, because we do the same role, and he asked me a question about how I integrate that into my actual personal life. And he was something he was struggling with. And I said, well, here's kind of the system that I've built to manage that problem. And he was like, oh my God, that's way better than what I do right now. And he was able to adopt what I do in his personal life to help him solve that problem. So, you know, we were solving a business problem. Serendipitously, it turned into helping him solve a personal problem and make his life easier at home. And it's like, that's the value of community, right? The workplaces really are our communities in a lot of ways. And so to be able to kind of all grow and develop together happens a lot more when you're in person as well.
Yeah. And again, the thing we have to think about is different people learn differently, right? Some people learn by reading. Some people learn by observing. Some people learn by actually doing it. So you need to be able to cater to all of those different kind of learners. And hybrid kind of provides you the ability to do all of that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're team hybrid here. Pinky and I.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. So you mentioned Ideal a few times. Mm-hmm. How long have you been in that role there?
4+ months now. We'll be finishing up 5 months pretty soon.
All right. So let's talk about this. I interviewed my cousin, who is actually a CEO, has been a CEO at a couple different places. And we talked about what it was like for him stepping into a new role and assessing his team. And I think that'd be an interesting conversation for you as well from a finance standpoint. So when you step into a new role, you mentioned LOL, listen, observe, and learn. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great mindset. But what else are you thinking about? What's your mindset? What are you looking for? And what types of things are you assessing as a CFO?
Yeah, so a lot of what I'm assessing first is actually the organizational needs. So what does the organization need for the finance function? And you'll get that feedback in all sorts of ways, right? You'll find out what are the things that we're doing well, what are the things that we're not doing well. And once you've been able to synthesize and actually get that download of where it is that finance is needed in the organization, then you're doing the strengths, weaknesses, almost like a SWOT analysis.
Yeah.
Like strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats, right? Less threats, I would say opportunities.
Do you have examples of what those are, though? Like, what are the categories that you might put into a strengths or weaknesses category?
Yeah, so it would be specific functions of what finance performs, right? So, hey, external audit and taxes that are done on an annual basis, it's a strength of the team, you know? Every year it gets done on time, no issue whatsoever. Weakness, really lack analytical abilities and all that. So the FP&A function is really lacking. Weakness, internal controls, you know, they have an understanding of internal controls, but, you know, really in terms of how to put them in place and ensure that they're managing those controls, not necessarily. So we've talked about internal controls, we've talked about accounting, we've talked about FP&A, the treasury piece is also another important aspect. So it's like, okay, so how are we on the treasury side? Who's managing the debt covenants? Is that something that is pretty smooth? Do we have that experience? Do we have people who are proactive thinkers, people who think beyond what's going on this month and are really thinking about what's going to happen the next 3 months and so forward-looking? Or are our views completely backward-looking and we're always just looking at historical and we're looking at trends, kind of tied into the FP&A function? So you try to assess all of those aspects and based on that, really understand where the organization is falling short. So then you try to look at it both from a process standpoint and a people standpoint. So the reason why we're not being able to show up and do what we need to do from a finance standpoint is that there's some kind of a lack of process, or do we not have the right capabilities on the team? If it's the latter and you don't have the right capabilities on the team, then you're basically doing a gap analysis. And in that gap analysis, you're assessing what is it that needs to get added? What's the kind of talent or skill set that needs to get added to the team that will make the organization whole or operate as a best-in-class finance organization? So those are the things that you start thinking about, and then you're pretty much thinking about it on a daily basis because you're developing a point of view and then you're iterating. So I developed a point of view 1 month in, and then I iterated. And what point of view I had 1 month in was 80% of what the organization needed to be. And then the other month and a half I spent iterating, having a conversation with HR, having a conversation with the CEO, having a conversation with the board, and really getting their feedback as well to make sure that, am I hearing right? Am I in line? Am I responsive? Am I responding to the way that we think the organization needs to evolve? And once you get that validation, then you're ready to kind of make that organizational move. So again, it really is very dependent on first developing a point of view, having that gap analysis in place, and then validating once you have the organization set.
I like what you said around assessing the process and the people, because I've seen a lot of new leaders step in, and when something's not working, it's like, well, the people are bad. It's, you know, this doesn't work. The people are bad. We need to bring in the new people, and teams get recycled very quickly. But I like stopping to differentiate between those two. Hey, is it, have we done this to ourselves, or is this the people and we need to fill those gaps in talent? I think that's important.
And you have to be mindful of biases as well. So I'll tell you, at US Soccer, there was a person on the team, manager of accounting, and he had 30 plus years of experience. And everybody was like, okay, well, you know, he's going to be retiring soon. So he's probably not a member of your go forward team. So you should really evaluate, like, you know, what new blood you need to bring in. But it doesn't matter. I don't care what his age is. I don't care what his experience is. For me, I really need to understand, is there a need for the skills that he's providing? And this person is still at US Soccer, and I have left US Soccer. So he's even outlasted my tenure with the organization. He was there before, and he's still there. And so you really need to make sure that you contain your biases and not look at team members as, oh, they're probably at a point and all that where they're ready to retire. So I don't think there's any value in continuing on in that, or for that person to continue in the organization.
I have another guest who will love to hear you say that, because we have recorded a conversation on age discrimination.
Oh,
so yes. So that is a topic that we have talked about on this show, and you absolutely reinforced it right there, which is great.
No age, no gender, nothing. It's all experience. That's the thing. It's like that's the only way to be objective in each of these assessments. The organizational assessment can only be objective if you're really looking at it in terms of what the organizational gaps are and what are those gaps in your team that you're looking to fill. If you start making it about age, gender, then it's going to get convoluted.
Yeah. And giving everybody a chance to be engaged, you know, not just assuming that they're not going to be engaged, but giving everybody a chance to fulfill whatever role you need them to fulfill, and then seeing how they react and adjusting accordingly. So yeah, I like that.
I think the only thing that I would caution against, which ends up happening, is change. So change makes people nervous. Change makes people fearful. And in the changes that we had at US Soccer, so in my tenure there, I went through three CEOs. And each time the CEO came in, there was just fear of, okay, you know, am I going to meet the standards of what this person needs? Am I going to be a fit? Are we going to have a good working relationship where we're able to connect with each other and really be business partners? So all of those questions arise. So what I have tried to do when I'm coming into an organization is I don't want to spend a year or 9 months saying that, hey, I'm going to listen and observe, because I know that it's going to create this uncertainty of, am I going to be part of the go-forward team, or am I not part of the go-forward team? What are the changes that she's planning? Has she communicated the changes? Do I know whether I'm going to have a say in it? What am I going to be doing? So I feel like that causes a lot of people to spin, and having experienced it from a CEO turnover standpoint, my commitment is within 90 days of coming into an organization, I'm going to have a plan. That, again, it might not be the fully baked plan, but I'm going to have a plan and I'm going to start down that path. So I pretty much kept to that rule of thumb of mine. And within 90 days, we had an organization announcement out.
And are you verbalizing that on day one to the people on your team? Like, is that a promise you're making to them?
I don't make the promise, because I don't know whether it's going to be 90 days, or it could be 120 days, or it could be 80 days. So I normally tell them that I give them a time period. Like, you know what? We're going to make some changes in January. So they know that something's coming and it's not too far out. It's not 6 months out. It's going to be a month out.
Yeah. So at least there is unknown. Yeah. At least they have certainty. A known, like, okay, this is when it's going to be. Because to your point, I mean, people will fill in all kinds of stories if they're not given the story.
Right.
We coincidentally, an announcement came out yesterday that our CEO is going to be stepping away from our organization. And in one day, I've already heard people say all kinds of things as to why they think it's happening or what it could mean. And the reality is, for all of the people I've talked to, it doesn't mean anything. Like they don't have any direct line to our CEO. They are still going to be doing their jobs. There's zero repercussion that it will impact them at all. And yet all these stories start to swirl. It's really interesting. And I think it's a good thing to keep in mind when you're leading any team is if there is any doubt at all, that gap is going to be filled with a story that you're probably not going to like.
I know. Or sometimes even after the fact, right? Even after you've made the announcement that it's a why. Why did this happen?
Yeah.
That stories will be there as well. And I think that the only thing that you can do in all of those situations is really tell people about the process. So as much insight that you can provide people in terms of the thinking, like what you thought, what you did, why you did it. And then at the end of the day, you know, people are all going to take a different view of what you did or what you didn't do. So you're not there to please people. You're there to tell them exactly how you thought about it and that it was an objective process.
Yeah. So let's talk about getting through that process a little bit more, because you'd mentioned that you had done your assessment and then you had gone to your CEO. And I think you mentioned the head of HR and maybe somebody at legal and kind of the board and kind of run these things by them. But I know in our prep for this, you had talked specifically around the importance of having some trusted internal team members as you do onboard into a new role to check yourself and your observations and to kind of give you guidance. So can you talk a little bit about that and who on your team you used as that resource?
So I have been fortunate enough that we've got a CFO who's retiring and he's not leaving till the end of the year. Hmm. So as far as the perceptions that were things that I was hearing about the finance organization, I was validating those with him in terms of, you know, where he thought the perceptions were true and where they weren't. And he was in those board meetings. So some of the feedback was coming from the board members as well, where they're sharing, you know, what they see as opportunities for the finance organization, which is, again, I'm somebody who's always of a continuous improvement mindset. So I am always hungry for feedback. You know, how can we do things better? How do we improve it quarter over quarter, year over year? So he was also privy to some of the feedback that we're getting. So I would say that he was one person where I felt like I could share. And there was no bias on his end, right? Because he's on his way out. So he's just trying to ensure that I'm set up for success as I'm kind of taking on the role after him. So he I would say, would be the one person. And I think the good part of that discussion is there was respect between the two of us. So where he may not agree with what direction I was taking, or where I might not agree with the feedback that he was providing, we still listened to each other and there was a dialogue. So if you think about it from a standpoint of, did I have my blinders on? He was there to make sure that he checked my blinders. Hmm.
And a lot of listeners to this show are HR professionals. And so can you talk about how you partnered with HR as part of that onboarding?
Oh, yeah. HR for me was super critical in this discussion of an organizational change, because for me, even before I felt comfortable in sharing my organizational thoughts with the CEO, I wanted to review them with the HR leader and see, here's kind of how I'm thinking about the roles and here's kind of what I'm thinking to add. What are your thoughts? And her feedback were so important, because I was so focused in, okay, here's kind of what's missing in the organization, that I was not really thinking about the current state. I was more focused on the future state. And so her thing was, okay, so how does that transition? How do you get from current state to future state? So I had, here's my current state slide and here's my future state slide. And her thing is, okay, and how do you bridge it?
Yeah. So, and I'm just going to fire everyone tomorrow and hire everybody else. And it's like, no, that's not how it's going to work.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So it's almost like the, okay, so how are you going to operationalize this transition from your current state to the future state? And so you need to think about it role by role, person by person. So first think about it from a role perspective and then think about it from a person perspective. So that reflection was so important because then what I did was just outside of putting an org chart together, next to each role, I said, okay, and here's kind of what I'm thinking about it in terms of how it transitions. And I was able to then even take it a step further and say, okay, and here's what I'm thinking about in the future state, but here's why it makes sense in the future state, because if we have this established in the future state, it's going to help for the long-term growth of the organization. It's going to help with the succession planning for the organization. So I started layering in, the work doesn't stop at the future state. The future state is more or less kind of bridging us from where we are right now to where we need to be to address the issues, which are more of a short-term thing. But then we kind of, if you take that as that future state now becomes your current state. And so what is your next future state? That's kind of where the succession planning comes in. So it's like, how do we start being talent developers and start really generating the pipeline of candidates from within the organization?
And so you have a unique background that I teased at the beginning because you have sat in the HR chair yourself, correct?
That I have.
Can you tell how that came to be and what you learned from that experience?
Yeah, so I actually ended up in that chair as a result of COVID. We were at a place where with our new CEO, Will Wilson at US Soccer, he realized that he did not have the flexibility of having a full team. So he ended up giving me both HR and IT. So in addition to the CFO function, I had the HR function and the IT function. And what I had to do with HR there was pretty much kind of set it up foundationally, because the only thing that we had for HR was payroll and benefits. If you talk about goal setting, you talk about performance reviews, you talk about a comp plan, none of that existed. So I had to be on the ground floor setting all of that up with really no experience in HR outside of having been a user of those functions. So got a team together. I think the benefit of COVID was a lot of things were not happening external to the organization. So you really pool the talent that you have within the organization to have them start looking into what the needs are from an HR perspective, and then get some external specialists as well. So we were able to cobble together all of that, actually develop principles and values for the organization during that time as well, and get feedback from the organization and from the leaders through surveys, as well as individual interviews, and really come up with our principles and values. So then when we did our performance reviews were not only about your performance, it was, are you living the values? So that was a year and a half, I would say, kind of, I would call it a rotation, because I knew that I never wanted HR permanently, but I went to a conference with Deloitte, and Deloitte said their human capital team was talking to us CFOs, and they said, you know what? We would recommend CFOs to have a rotation in HR because it really helps them understand how to manage talent or how to develop talent. And I think I was able to have that unique perspective through being in that chair. Now, as I start thinking about my organizations and how talent development and succession planning is something that I keep on harping on, but it's true that experience that I've had where, you know, our people are our best assets. So how do we make sure that we're spending the time growing and developing them? And one last thing I'll say on that is, in the public company that I was, one of the metrics that the divisional CFOs used to be measured on was if you're a net exporter of talent. So if you're bringing in less people than you are exporting out, that was supposed to be a good thing. So if we have metrics like that in place and we actually exceed those metrics, then that really shows in all that you're actually internally developing your talent pool.
Got it. So what surprised you the most about taking on an HR role?
How so many decisions tend to be driven on emotions rather than objectivity, right? So finance tends to be very data-driven function, right? Your numbers are up or numbers are down. Why are numbers up and why are numbers down? With employees and all that, performance is up, performance is down. It's there's not really data. It's well, you know, their manager basically is somebody that is not coaching and developing them, or they're having issues with their peers, or it's the work. So it tends to be more subjective. So the binary aspect of what you can get in the finance world, you can't get that in HR.
So what did you learn from that experience?
Then you have to be patient, you know, with people. You have to be patient. And it's, again, not a one size fits all. You have to really mold yourself as a manager in terms of how you're working with different employees. So, you know, you might have one employee and all that who is a real high performer, and they are going to get bored easily. So you need to make sure that you're one step ahead and you're constantly giving them projects to keep them engaged. You've got another employee who is wants to kind of take it easy. You know, they're okay with doing just the same thing over and over again. Okay. They probably are somebody and all that who is more suited for the day-to-day accounting aspect of it. So you probably want to put them on accounts payable, accounts receivable, on maybe the external audit, because they don't want that much change. They want it to be the same year after year. So you really have to, again, assess the talent that you have, see which situations they're going to thrive in, and then based on that, really try to put them in those places so that you are setting them up for success.
Interesting. That is easier said than done, to be patient and customize your approach to each person. So it sounds great to hear you say it, but it is tough in the moment when you mentioned emotions, when they're emotional and you get emotional, right? Because it's easy to get frustrated with somebody who doesn't have the same goals or style that you do, but to be mm-hmm. able to recognize who they are for who they are and adjust the way that you handle them, that it takes a lot of practice.
It does. I would say the other thing that that the HR experience has taught me is not to be afraid to make fun of yourself. So
okay.
I feel that in corporate America, especially, there's so much hierarchy. And so you tend to have team members who necessarily don't feel comfortable sharing their ideas. So how do you get to a point where you make those team meetings such that there's humor in there? And if you make fun of the team, the team also feels equally comfortable to, you know, pull your leg and make fun of you. Again, all in respect and kind of boundaries, yeah. But have to bring that lighthearted laughter in your day-to-day management as well. Because, I mean, if you think about, you know, the finance role, it's a work hard, play hard kind of environment. So you've got your deadlines. You know, accuracy is so important. There's so many things that you've got your hands in from a financial perspective. So you need to be able to take a minute and be able to laugh at yourself and bring humor into the team.
I love that. That's a great learning. So let's flip back to the current work that you're doing, because you've mentioned succession planning a few times. Mm-hmm. So
yep.
How are you now thinking about, you're through your 90 days. I know you've kind of put your plan in place. You haven't outlined it here, but I know you and I had talked about it ahead of time. You put your plan in place. You started to make some of those changes. Now you're starting to think about the succession planning for those roles. What does that look like? What's the actual process for building future talent?
So the interesting thing is, when people think succession planning, they're like, okay, so it's succession planning for the CFO role. Okay, so who's going to be your successor? And that's really not succession planning. That's a very narrow view of succession planning. The succession planning is for every key role that you have in your organization. You want to make sure that you have a plan, right? Mm. So do you have a pipeline? And if you do it right, you basically say, hey, you know, what are the skills that are required for somebody to be successful in this role of, let's say, director? And then based on those skills that you've identified, you're okay, the person who is in the role right now, how many years do you think they will be in that role? Okay, they're going to be in that role 3 more years. So, okay, so do you have anybody in the organization that can potentially be groomed into that role? Well, yes or no. Okay, so that means we're going to have to go outside for that role. At what level do you think we need to bring that role in? Do we need to bring them at a manager level, or do we need to bring them at a senior level? So you really have to start kind of, you know, going backwards from, okay, here's what now your future state, which has become now your current state of the organization is. So all your positions are filled. Now, as you start looking at when those positions try to move up and get promoted or take something different on for yeah. their own development, how is that backfill
yeah.
happening? And that backfill is really the succession planning. And again, the answer can be that it has to be an external resource, but that planning and thought process should already exist now, not when that person says, oh, okay, I would like to take that role. And you're like, oh, I don't have an internal. Okay, so we need to go hire for this.
Yeah.
That's more reactionary. Through a succession planning, everything is already kind of figured out that, hey, these three roles of the six roles in the finance organization, there is an internal candidate that can be groomed into it. And actually, we can start the work now.
Yeah.
We can start the work, three years looking forward, we can start the work now. So we've got enough time to ramp them up into that. Or we don't have that. So you know what? We should actually just start softly looking in the market and saying, okay, if this happens, what kind of candidates are we looking for? And are there things out there externally and all that would make sense for this role rather than, again, it being reactive? So it's all just succession planning, just basically is proactive managing of your organization
of
and
every
talent
role.
Movements.
Yeah. Well, I love what you said too about the forethought and thinking about not just are we going to have to hire for this role, but if we do have to hire for this role, where should we bring them in? You know, because I think a lot of people think, oh, well, we'll hire for the role. Great. When they move up, we'll hire for the role. But it's like, well, are people successful stepping into that role from outside the organization and just picking it up and running? Or do we need to hire them in at a lower role and give them a year in the organization to get their feet under them so that they're really well qualified, they have the relationships that they need in that role, and they can step right into it? I think that's a really insightful comment.
Yeah, and the other thing, if you think about it, like from my own experience, I'm coming here as a CFO. It takes a long time for you to basically get ingrained with what the day-to-day needs are. And sometimes it is about a year that it takes for you to go through the full cycle of what are the things that are needed to be done. Now, if you had an internal candidate pipeline of CFO, there's so many things they already know about the organization. So that transition into CFO for them is going to be so much easier than somebody who's coming brand new where they don't know the company, they don't know the product, they don't know the market, they don't know the strategy, they don't know the management team, they don't know the board. There's so many don't knows. They don't know the partners, the third-party partners. So it's a steep learning curve. Not that it can't be done. I mean, there's so many CFO transitions that happen. But I just think that it makes so much easier. The other thing I would say is, as I've been in different organizations, when the folks who are within the organization see that the top positions are always being hired from outside, it just creates a level of dissatisfaction for them because they're like, okay, you know, I've been loyal to the organization. Why was I not considered for that promotion? Or why was I not considered for that role? Now, that might be, again, internal development that was not provided to them, that if you had a succession planning, then the leader would potentially have provided them that training ahead of time and made them ready for the role. So not again, thinking about it futuristically has kind of set them back. But when you start promoting from within, I think that it creates so much motivation. So it's like now you've got an engaged workforce that's motivated because they're seeing that there's promotions and they want to be considered for promotions. So again, I would say it's probably an HR person's dream from a cultural standpoint that you're now, you know, created that engagement and motivation.
Yeah. As a CFO, how do you think about investments in talent development and leadership development?
So I think investments, when people think of investments, I'm sure their first thought goes to money. Mm-hmm. And I would say when you think about investments, you need to think about it actually in two aspects. Yes, money, but the other is time investment.
Sure.
So if I kind of use the example again that I have of a director, how much is the CFO going to invest with the director in terms of coaching and developing them? So what is that time investment they're going to take? So are they going to say, hey, you know what? I'm going to have 6 one-on-one meetings with you for 1 hour. And those meetings are not going to be about your updates and your progress. It's going to be strictly focused on your development, what you want to do, and what are the things that we need to do to get you there, right? So it's that time investment of constantly speaking with them. Those conversations should hopefully also lead to exposure in terms of, okay, what are the things that we need to expose you to? Some of those things are going to be internal and some of those things might be external. So, hey, you know, we don't have this offered within our company. So we probably want to send you to a conference or send you to a seminar. And that's kind of where you're going to get that exposure. Mm. So that's potentially where the money aspect of it comes in. So it's this combination of what is the coaching development that you need and the time investment you need, along with what is that external training and investment that you need to provide to get them. But I think, again, all of that still gets tied back to the succession planning, because at the end of the day, it's like, okay, this person is in a director box. Which box do they want to go to? And what are the things that are needed in that box? And that box is going to kind of determine what are the investments we need to make. So even if there's a time investment that I'm making in the role, I'm making the time investment specific to what? We're not just having conversations. We're having conversations geared towards delegation skills, executive skills, presentation skills, analytical skills. What is it that we're trying to get to so that I can be coaching and developing in that area? And then potentially giving them opportunities to fail and giving them opportunities to try that skill out without it being really very serious, right? So, hey, you know, your first presentation is going to be to the board. No, actually, you know what? Your first presentation could be to the directors when we have our controllers conference or when we have our finance meeting. Why don't you present this topic about this research that you did to this group? And then field the questions and see how you respond. Oh, you actually did pretty well on that one. Here are probably a couple of things that you could do. Let's now try it with the presidents and the GMs. Oh, you did pretty well with the presidents and GMs. Okay, now let's do it with the board. So you're slowly coaching them and getting them confident as they're in smaller settings, which are potentially less scary. And then getting to the point where what they really need to get to, which is presenting to a board, they get to the point where they're comfortable because they've now fielded questions in different settings and they can think on their feet. They feel pretty comfortable doing it. So even the fear is lessened when that time comes. And I'm using board as an example. I mean, it could be an external presentation to 50 internal auditors. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I totally follow along. So if I can kind of synthesize what you're saying here, because I think it's great, but I have not really heard many leaders define it as clearly as you've defined it before, which is look at every person on your team, figure out where they want to go and what are the skills needed to get them there, and then help them develop those specific skills to get there.
Yep.
And then figure out what then that means, who then is going to fill their role, and how you need to be developing those people to fit that role.
Yep.
So I like that, because you're looking at each person, you're tailoring it to where they want to go, you're then listing skills, and then you're developing specific skills. It's just a very purposeful, pragmatic way to do it, but it's also very customized and human-centric, right? And focused on the person and what they want. So I love the way that you've combined those two in a not easy, but a very simple kind of layout. I think that'd be really impactful for organizations to take that on and train all their managers. If every manager did that exercise and committed to developing their people with those skills, like every organization would be a better place to work.
I know. I think in larger organizations, what happens is they get hampered with time, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's such a customized, tailored approach. Do you have the time to be able to have that with each of your employees? If you've got a 50-person organization with like 8 direct reports, can you really afford that level of time with each of your team members? But what I will say is, going back to the Deloitte conference that we had, the reason why Human Capital was having a discussion with us around talent is, how do companies differentiate themselves? You can throw more money at candidates. You can throw titles. But at the end of the day, how do you retain candidates and how do you show how you're different? So what is your value proposition? And I think if you want to retain talent or you want to attract talent, either way, right? Retention, attraction, you have to show how you're differentiating yourself in terms of investing in their growth and development. And if you do, I would say it's even a generational thing. I think the younger generations that are coming in, for them, they want that relationship. They want to know that their manager really cares about their personal growth and development. And if you're able to convey that, or if you're able to show that when they come on board in your organization, your chances of them staying longer or being loyal to you are significantly higher.
Pinky, this has been fantastic. A ton of really great insight for people in here, both just into the CFO role in general, and also just in thinking about how they manage the human capital on their team. This is awesome. Any final thoughts, anything you didn't get to share that you had wanted to today?
I would say that I think a lot of people tend to think about the CFO function as a function that's really around managing and mitigating risk, right? Or value creation. And I hope that through this conversation that we've had, it's like it's so much more than just risk mitigation and risk management and value creation. They're really these building blocks with people and processes that are constantly center of mind for the CFO role, because we are now getting very much aligned with HR in terms of realizing how important attracting and retaining talent is.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show, sharing your perspective and your wisdom. You can see why you were nominated and won CFO of the Year. I love the way you were thinking about this stuff. You very clearly have thought through a lot of this stuff and have perspective and tools and opinions. So thank you for sharing it here.
No, I appreciate it. One last thing that I would add to this is some of these things get shaped by your own personal experiences. So when you experience certain things, you hope that when you become a leader, that you will make things better. And so that's the other thing that I would say that drives me to continue to improve things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I spent a lot of time in environments I did not like, and I very strongly want to make sure that I create better environments for the people I work with. That is it's a driver for me too. So yeah, it's worth having some bad experiences. You know, nobody wants to have a bad experience, but they are formative. You know, they don't call them formative years and formative experiences for no reason. So, all right, everybody, good luck out there. Hopefully your bad experiences you can learn from, and Pinky's great example you can also learn from, and be the best people and finance leaders that you can be.
Hey folks, one last thing before you go. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to hit subscribe so you can stay up to date with future guests. That's it. Thanks for coming. Go make the most of your business and the people in it.